From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, in the middle of London's workday, a blast of news that seemed like dark déjà vu. Three explosions again on the London subway and one on a bus. This Thursday, there are no casualties, but Scotland Yard says the bombs were meant to kill. The coordinated but apparently bungled attacks came exactly 2 weeks after the deadly July 7th bombings, also on three subway trains and one bus, that killed 56. Tonight on Point, a second round of attacks in London, and Britain responds to terror. We begin tonight in London with the latest on today's attacks. British Prime Minister Tony Blair today urged his countrymen to resist fear.
I think what's important is that people do stay calm and react in the way that they have reacted so far. And the very purpose of the people who are doing this type of thing, that their purpose is precisely in order to make people worried and frightened.
Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. He's been following the news in London since the moment it began to unfold. I asked him to describe what is known now about the day's confusing events.
Well, you're certainly right that there was a lot of confusion and there was that horrible sinking feeling that it was just like the same events of 2 weeks ago. But things are beginning to settle down a little bit. Right, here's what we know. What the police say is that there were four attempts to set off explosive devices, just like 2 weeks ago, three on an underground train, one on a bus, but that they did not detonate properly. Several eyewitnesses certainly heard explosions, which may have been the detonating devices, but the bombs didn't go off. So at the end of the day, we have no casualties, we have no serious injuries, no fatalities, and we have a massive manhunt for whoever was responsible for planting these devices, and a huge forensic treasure trove for the police, who, because this time they don't have crime scenes where everything is blown to bits, this time they have the devices.
Presumably, they've now retrieved and begun to investigate those devices. Does it look as though they were intended to cause mass casualties?
Well, certainly Sir Ian Blair, who's the head of the London Metropolitan Police, doesn't believe this was just an attempt to scare Londoners, to show that devices could be placed, but that this was a failed attempt to kill an awful lot of Londoners. He said, what other intention could there be other than to kill? Why on earth would people do this? So, in other words, the police are working on the theory that this was intended to be just like 2 weeks ago, but that somehow the bombs didn't go off.
Can you describe for us the scenes in the underground, in the London subways today, as passengers apparently began to perceive that they were under attack?
Well, horribly similar to 2 weeks ago. Horribly, horribly similar. Down in the underground stations, there was a certain amount of panic. People were running. But then I think it quickly dawned on people that explosions had not happened on the scale of 2 weeks ago, because I was outside one of the underground stations 2 weeks ago when people started emerging very, very badly shaken, talking about having seen bodies, having seen lots of blood. That did not happen this time, but that's not, of course, to say that people weren't very frightened, that there wasn't a great deal of panic, because this time people are more jittery. 2 weeks ago it came from out of the blue. This time no one could say this came out of the blue.
Rob, have the police said anything more about why the bombs did not go off? It seems strange that all four, three on the underground, one on a bus, would not detonate. Why?
The police haven't said anything, but former intelligence officials and explosive experts have said there is one possible theory, and that is that if these bombs were made of the same substance and material as the bombs 2 weeks ago, in other words, if the material was from the same batch, perhaps 2 weeks later, they had lost some of their potency. But I say these are theories from outsiders. The police have not yet to offer a theory.
And what about the would-be bombers? We heard reports of authorities there chasing suspects around town into a hospital. Anyone captured, near capture? Where does that stand?
Well, we've heard that there have been two arrests, but the police have said they are not directly connected to the bombing attack. So I think that it's fair to say that a massive manhunt is now underway. The police at the underground stations were appealing to people to come forward. Look, what did you see? Did you see anyone suspicious? Did you see anyone run away? So the police are hoping that the public are going to be their very best asset in this case.
And what about new measures that are being implemented or being called for now after this second apparent bombing attempt
to tighten security, to toughen up law enforcement? How's the UK responding?
Well, a great deal of measures are in the pipeline following the attacks 2 weeks ago, and some of them are legal measures, some are intelligence measures, although they have not been announced. But in broad terms, the legal measures are creating new criminal offences that would make it easier to prosecute people in connection with terrorism, and also this idea of giving the government powers to deport clerics who were saying extremist, hateful and inciting things. Now, that process may be speeded up, but as for securing the underground, that the mayor of London was asked, well, what can you do? How can you make the underground secure? And the mayor said, well, look, the only thing you could do was to make it like an airport. But just try to imagine putting 3 million people a day, that's the number of people that use the underground, through the kind of measures needed to get them on a plane. They would just never ever get to work.
Rob, we see reports today of London police calling for sweeping new powers, such as holding terrorism suspects for up to 3 months without charge.
I think that is perhaps, along with the possibility of deporting undesirables, the most dramatic measure that the government could take. I'm not entirely sure that will happen. It is sure to face stiff opposition from some in the House of Commons, from some members of Parliament, and I suspect from lawyers and civil rights groups too.
Rob, what's your sense of how Londoners are absorbing these apparently attempted attacks today? It can't seem like a one-off anymore. This is two in 2 weeks. How are people taking that on board?
Well, we British are pretty stiff upper lipped. I think we're famous for that, and people are still drinking in the pubs. They're still going to come in and out of work. I mean, in a way, you know, people just don't have very much choice. But look, I can tell you, travelling on the underground every day, twice a day, that people are a bit more jittery than they were. I mean, I think that's only to be expected. But one thing, again, that the Mayor of London pointed out is that in the 1970s and 80s, there were a lot of attacks by the Irish Republic, the Provisional IRA, and people got used to that. Now, will they get used to this? Who knows?
Rob, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with us from London. It is 2 weeks to the day since Londoners reacted with that famous stiff upper lip to a coordinated series of deadly blasts that killed 56 people and injured 700. Since then, a massive police investigation in England has identified the suicide bombers and reached into Egypt and Pakistan. A British man named as an Al-Qaeda chief has been linked to the attacks. There have been calls to criminalize hate speech, to limit immigration, and to increase the government's ability to spy on British citizens. This hour on Point, a second round of attacks, and Britain responding to terror. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you see the events of the past 2 weeks in London? Does this second round of attacks, however botched, drive the fear deeper? And is this the war in Iraq coming home to the UK or something else? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Peter Bergen. He's an authority on Al-Qaeda, a fellow at the New America Foundation, and author of Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden. Peter Bergen, thank you for joining us again.
Good
tonight.
Evening.
It was just 2 weeks ago, today we were talking about the first attack. Now there's a second. It seems strangely inept or bungled. What's your interpretation of the news coming out of London, Peter?
I mean, my interpretation is the following. You know, much has been made, and, you know, Rob Watson was talking about the British stiff upper lip and all that. But if another attack happens, you know, the kind of mantra that Blair has been repeating and Ken Livingstone, the mayor of London, that, you know, let's go about business as usual, that is not going to cut it. I mean, clearly with a second set of attacks, and there is a cell out there who has not been found as yet, you know, the possibility of a third attack is quite a reasonable expectation, I think. And I think that we're already seeing, as Rob Watson sort of outlined, you know, a dramatically potentially changing legal environment where, you know, it would be a crime to encourage or incite acts of terrorism. Some of the more egregious clerics getting perhaps deported back to their native countries, where previously they could claim asylum on the basis that they might be either tortured or face the death penalty in their native countries. I think that a number of clerics, for instance, Abu Qatada, he's a Jordanian, he's sort of the spiritual leader of the group that Zakawi is running in Iraq at this point, He was being detained by British authorities. The House of Lords said it was basically unconstitutional or illegal to keep holding him, and then he was released a few months back. I think that people like Qatada, the British government's going to take a pretty hard look at and say, you know, what's the upside here for us? I certainly, when you've got, you know, four successful attacks and now four sort of botched attacks in the space of 2 weeks, this is very different from the IRA. Sure, the IRA, you know, there was a campaign of bombings, but it wasn't intended to kill as many people as possible. It's a very different scale. It wasn't sort of multiple attacks in the capital. It was, you know, it's a very different kind of thing. I grew up in London. I remember bombs going off, a few blocks from our house, and we'd go. It was kind of exciting as a kid to go and see what the bomb was doing. But they weren't designed to kill lots of people. They were designed. They were designed to send signals. Sometimes they did kill people.
Peter, do you have any doubt that these bombs today were intended to kill a lot of people? They didn't, as it turns out. But
Ian Blair, the metropolitan, the head of the Metropolitan Police, said they were intended to kill people, and I think he's a, it seems that they were. Thankfully, it didn't work out.
Deep underground again, and up on the bus, a copycat, a bungle, but four bombs meant to go off, meant, we're told, to kill. Peter Bergen, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about a second round of attacks in London. How do you read what's going on in the UK in the last 2 weeks? Is this a reign of terror as a way of life come to London? Does this second round, however botched, drive the fear deeper, make it seem a constant threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about today's second round of attacks in London and about Britain responding to terror. You can join the conversation tonight. An ocean away, do you feel vulnerable or secure? And what is the right response to two attacks in 2 weeks? Is this the war in Iraq coming home to the UK? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from Washington tonight by Peter Bergen, author of Holy War Inc. He's an adjunct professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And right now, from Bradford, England, by Paul Rogers, professor of peace studies at the University of Bradford. He's an expert on terrorism, post-Cold War global security and proliferation. He's author of A War on Terror, Afghanistan, and After. Paul Rogers, I know it's late there. Thank you for joining us this evening.
I'm pleased to be with you.
Your first thoughts on today's attacks, bungled as they were, what are the implications?
Well, there are positive and negative implications. The positive ones are that, of course, they were bungled and people weren't killed. And also there's been a tremendous forensic trawl for the police. They will be able to find out a huge amount about the modus operandi, the actual constituents of the bombs. They may well succeed in capturing those responsible.
And that is because the backpacks, the rucksacks, were left on the trains and did not explode. Is that right?
Well, in three of the four cases, the detonators went off, but relatively little damage was done. Mm-hmm. In the fourth case, at the Shepherd's Bush subway station, even the detonator did not work. So they have a complete rucksack there, and they have a lot of evidence elsewhere. Mm. So that's the positive side. The negative side is that this does seem to be a completely different cell from the one that did the atrocities 2 weeks ago. The reason I say that is where I live is really quite close to where three of the four suicide bombers last fortnight ago lived. And talking to the local police, they have been working with an incredible intensity to uncover the wider network associated with those individuals. Mm-hmm. And I think it's almost certain that if there had been another cell closely connected with this group, information would have been available on that. So the implication is that this is another cell working in parallel but to an extent in isolation, and that is of course a cause of real concern.
And given that it was so utterly bungled, I guess you'd have to say, from the attacker's perspective, from anyone's perspective, does that leave you thinking these are two professional cells or one professional cell and here are some kind of amateur copycat operation?
Bit difficult to say at the moment, but the information that's come from the Metropolitan Police at New Scotland Yard in the last 2 or 3 hours is that as far as they can see, the devices were very similar to the ones used 2 weeks ago. It's possible that there may have been a deterioration in the explosive constituents. It's possible there may have been one single fault which applied to all four. So it's not necessarily a major bungle. It might be quite a small fault, but and a hugely welcome one all the same. So the police are actually being very cautious at present, and in addition I understand that in most cases they are being very careful in terms of even looking at the packages. The bomb squads are working very slowly just in case these devices are still dangerous, so they don't have a full picture yet.
Peter Bergen in Washington, what does this leave you thinking? A UK riddled with terrorist cells, or a very few and copycats? I mean, you know, 2 and 2 weeks, and so specifically, obviously planned to mimic the first attacks. How organized, how deep an organization does that leave you picturing behind these attacks?
Well, according to the British Home Office estimates that there are sort of 10,000 Al-Qaeda sympathizers, what broadly speaking, in the country. It also estimates that several hundred have trained in Kashmir and several hundred have trained in Afghanistan. So those numbers sort of speak for themselves. A lot of those people, you know, may have hung up their jihadi, shoes, and they may not, you know, be active. Clearly, the British have had a very effective anti-terrorism police force. They interrupted a major plot back in 2004 that involved half a ton of ammonium nitrate, mostly British citizens of Pakistani descent, as we've seen in the London attacks. And I would speculate the following. I think it's a reasonable way to go. The fact that three of these guys on the London terror attacks had been to Pakistan last year and spent a certain amount of time there leads me to think that when the investigation is completed, that one or more of them will have ended up and received some training from either Lashkar-e-Toiba, one of the big Kashmiri militant groups, or a smaller one like Jaish Mohammed. Because, you know, the operating theory on the explosives is it may be something called TATP, which is a very high explosive. It's a little unstable to work with, the sort of thing that you can actually make from homemade ingredients, but you would have to have some knowledge to make. Mm. I don't think that's the sort of thing you pick up, in Leeds. This is something that you've learned, I think, in Pakistan. And again and again, we're seeing a sort of a Pakistani imprint. I mentioned the ammonium nitrate.
Yes. Of course, that you can get in any country. That's fertilizer.
Yes, yes. But the group of people who were doing this were either second generation or first generation Pakistani immigrants. And that, of course, sort of, I mean, why would they be engaging in this activity? Well, it turns out that, you know, 22% of young Muslim men are unemployed. There's a fair lack of integration, a certain amount of alienation. It's not just a class thing, of course, because Omar Sheikh, who killed Danny Pearl, is also second-generation British Pakistani descent. He went to London School of Economics. His parents were very prosperous. One of the London terror cells, a guy, you know, was a relatively well-off guy running a fish and chip shop. So it's not simply a class thing, but it is something, I think, about alienation. And frankly, I mean, I grew up in England as an American. And, you know, the British, it's hard to become fully British if you're, I'm sure there is multiculturalism, et cetera, but it's not simply, you know, peculiar to Britain. It's true in France and Germany and in Spain. There's a certain amount of sort of low-key racism.
Peter, are you suggesting in that the United States is by some degree less vulnerable, more immune to this kind of attack, or not?
Yes, I am suggesting. I mean, there is the American dream in this instance works. I mean, obviously it hasn't worked perfectly in other instances. Mm-hmm. We have our own problems with racism. But the fact is that second-generation American Muslims who come to this country, they become dentists. They don't volunteer to fight in Kashmir, as we've seen hundreds of young Brits doing in the past several years. It's a very different kind of scene. It's a very different. We don't have sleeper cells in this country. That's been a much, much exaggerated notion. But
you can say that just flatly. We do not have sleeper cells in the United States.
I will source that to the FBI, which in March an elite report said we found little or no evidence of American sleeper cells. And if we did have sleep, at a certain point, sleeper cells are so asleep they're effectively dead. And if, you know, the Iraq War was a tremendous moment for them to strike, they didn't. The election was a big moment, they didn't. We've had very isolated examples, and you may remember the case in Lodi, California, the only case I can think of, a second-generation Pakistani-American guy who went to Pakistan after 9/11, maybe attended a training camp, according to the federal government. that is an exception that proves the rule. But we're seeing lots of people attending training camps with British passports or with Spanish passports.
Right, pretty active travel there. Paul Roberts, in England, let me turn to you on this point. How do you trace the taproot here? Primarily to alienation, inequities, lack of integration of a set of Muslim immigrants, or to, more directly, to the kind of appeals that we hear from Osama bin Laden, from Al-Qaeda? You've got the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, reporting this week. Tony Blair didn't like this, but they said Britain's alliance with the United States in the war in Iraq has increased the country's risk. So where do you see the taproot going?
It is pretty complex. I agree with very much with the general line that Peter Bergen was saying. It is very complicated. The Pakistani connection is very strong. Quite a significant minority, but quite a big minority of the immigrant communities in Britain from South Asia have come from the Mirpur district of Pakistan, maybe coming into really low-paid labouring jobs in Britain. And they have had the most difficulty in sort of making their way in society, quite different from some of the other South Asian diaspora in Britain. But there are many different factors involved, and one has to admit that the wider issue of how the war on terror is being conducted, and I think particularly events in Iraq, is having quite a profound effect. One of the things that's been very common, I've talked to young Muslims myself in the last couple of weeks, but I've also seen it in some of the good current affairs programs, is a double view expressed almost in the same breath. One, abhorrence at what happened in London 2 weeks ago and antagonism to those who carried it out and the slaughter of innocent people, including many Muslims who were killed in the subway. But at the same time, almost in the same breath, a deep anger at what is happening in Iraq, because that is so widely covered in Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, on the websites, readily communicated into homes in Britain. So there are two different things happening at the same time, but that underlying theme of opposition to what is seen to be happening in Iraq is actually quite powerful at the present time.
Paul Rogers in Bradford, England. Peter Bergen here in the U.S. Please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Terrence Taylor. He joins us from Washington. He's president and executive director of the U.S. Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, served as an officer in the British Army on counterterrorism missions against the IRA, was a chief inspector to the UN Special Commission on Iraq. He was in London during the July 7th attacks. Terrence Taylor, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much.
So here we see 2 weeks later a bungled attack, nevertheless an attack that brings London pretty much to a halt, it seems, for about 3 hours in the middle of the day. We've got a major financial center, a national capital, with just four failed bombs, creating an enormous disruption. How do you gauge the impact of these attacks, whether very successful ones like 2 weeks ago or duds like today? Does it change the viability of a city of London's size, or does London just take it in stride?
Well, I think just taking it in stride, I don't think that's a true characterization that is possible. But certainly it's too early to tell yet. I think if it was just these two attacks, I think it could be taken on board. And it doesn't take much to disrupt a subway system or an underground system or buses or main rail system.
Or a city by doing that, amazingly little.
Yes, and certainly the Irish Republican Army tried that several times, as Peter Bergen referred to earlier on, but not causing the scale of casualties that we saw on July the 7th. But nevertheless, a number of the IRA attacks, particularly their later ones, were designed to cause large numbers of casualties, not in Britain and not in London, but certainly in Northern Ireland itself, in the Remembrance Day parades, for example, and the shopping centres attacks in the early 90s. And, of course, London's seen a mortar attack on number 10 Downing Street. Mm-hmm. And back in the 80s, the British Cabinet was attacked by a massive bomb at the Conservative Party conference in Brighton. But there is a history of these attacks. But I think it's wrong to say that people get used to this kind of thing. No one gets used to bomb attacks like this, particularly if they cause large casualties. But there is a certain resilience, and I think that certainly exists from my observation in London recently and knowledge of the history of these kinds of attacks. People in general tend to rally to the government side, tend to be supportive of more rigorous measures. We're in that situation now. Of course, we don't know what will happen in the future, and that's the real uncertainty.
Terrence Taylor, look with us for a moment at the new measures that the government's beginning to roll out here, much tougher on hate speech, looking to deportation in the case of people who are seen as provoking terror, much tougher on immigration in general, more capacity to be given to the London, very likely, to spy on Britons in their own country. How do you assess the kind of the speed and vigor with which England, the UK, is ramping up its counter-terror operations post July 7?
Well, I mean, we're looking at a process that's been going on really since the September the 11th attacks, 2001. There have been new terrorism acts brought in, and the legislation has been progressively strengthened. But on these particular issues that you mentioned, probably the most contentious one is the one that impacts directly on hate, if you put it this way, expressions, the support for terrorism and things like that. That's obviously the most contentious area, and inciting attacks, etc. And that will obviously be clearly challenged to be the most difficult area. Deportation, probably rather less so, but it would depend on the circumstances. But you have to remember, of course, that the people who carried out the attacks, or it seems in July the 7th, were actually British citizens. And we don't know about the group that have carried out these attempts today. So that's only a partial solution. But obviously, a government wants to strengthen its security measures. The time to do that is immediately in the wake of these attacks, and there's a certain momentum behind it to get it through parliamentary procedures.
And Paul Rogers, we're also told, being seriously considered, giving the government capacity to hold terror suspects for up to 30 days without charges. Are Britons welcoming this tightening, or are they concerned about civil liberties? How's it being looked at?
It's being looked at in really two rather different ways. There is a certain general welcoming, but also an unease. The interesting thing is that unease is expressed partly by what you might call the normal civil liberties lobby, also to an extent by the judges, by the judiciary. There are elements of unease there. It's the old story about quick laws being bad laws, and there's an unease that if you rush things through without thinking them through very carefully, then you may actually be finding that some of the new legal procedures are counterproductive. Also, I think there are fairly strong memories of the position about 30 years ago when Britain bought in internment in the Northern Ireland conflict, expecting it to have a major positive effect from their standpoint, and frankly it didn't. So I think there are certain questions there about how far you go and how quickly. But broadly speaking, the government probably has enough cross-party political support to bring in new measures, but we do have a gap with Parliament down for the next 3 months, and in that time, though, I think there will be quite an intense debate about how far to go.
Peter Bergen, what's your sense of the UK's willingness to go much further? Two attacks in 2 weeks. Just with this, you've got a high degree of concern. If you see another one, another two, could we see the UK evolving into a security state that we would not have possibly foreseen or imagined a couple of years ago?
Well, as you know, Karl Marx is buried in Highgate Cemetery, and that's for a very good reason. You know, London and England generally has a long and honourable tradition of tolerating dissent and being home to dissidents of all stripes. But I think that, you know, even before July 7th, the British government was really changing its posture. There was kind of mixed messages, because on the one hand, the House of Lords said that a number of people who had been detained, I believe about nine, including the cleric Abu Qatada, who I mentioned, should be released. On the other hand, they finally got around to, after the United States had requested the extradition of Abu Hamza, one of the more egregious clerics in London, at whose mosque Richard Reid the Shoebomber worshipped, etc.,
right.
etc., they finally got around to, you know, the UK to putting Abu Hamza on trial for incitement of racial hatred, which, of course, would be a very difficult charge in this country because of the First Amendment and other charges. And so I think the posture of the UK government has been hardening in this area. But as both of your guests, I think, have indicated, you know, I think back to this guy, Mazari, who was an Arab, a well-known Saudi dissident who was going to, the government wanted to deport to Domenico, a tiny island in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. As my memory serves, the House of Lords turned around and said, that you simply can't do that. And Mazari still lives now in London. So, you know, obviously there's going to be a debate. Things will be strengthened. I don't anticipate a sort of, a UK version of the Patriot Act times to the power of 10. I mean, it's just not in the British tradition.
Well, are you suggesting that the measures they're considering are still fall short of what the Patriot Act permits? My sense was that they go further.
They do. I mean, when I say something that was, you know, Patriot Act plus, I don't see that. And but, you know, if a third attack happens, I mean, just do the thought experiment where a second major attack happens inside the United States. We would have a, I mean, people tolerate, the one thing they can't tolerate is insecurity, as we see in Iraq.
Yes.
And that's the, security trumps all other concerns. And I think in the United States, there would be an amping up, a very significant amping up of the Patriot Act. If a third attack happened in London, I think some of these debates about civil liberties would kind of disappear, because I think that people would really understand that their way of life, to some degree, is being threatened by this.
We've got to take a short break here. I want to come back and look at the Pakistan connection. Peter Bergen and Terrence Taylor in Washington, Paul Rogers in Bradford, England, please stand by. We're looking tonight at the second round of attacks in London and Britain responding to terror. You can join us with two attacks in 2 weeks. Would you ride the subway, the bus, in your town? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the second round of attacks today in London and Britain responding to terror. You can join us tonight. How do you read what's going on in the UK? How do you respond to the violence of terrorism without becoming hostage to it? And an ocean away, do you feel vulnerable or secure in the USA? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Peter Bergen, author of Holy War, Inc., and Terrence Taylor, Executive Director of the U.S. Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Paul Rogers joins us from the University of Bradford in England. He's author of A War on Terror, Afghanistan and After. Right now, Tim joins us from New York City. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Early, up until early this year when I retired, I was involved in outreach to the Muslim community for the police department in New York to some extent.
Great. And, what did you see there?
I really didn't see radicalism. Like, I have to agree with one of your guests there. For the most part, they were, you know, these are people looking to work inside the system. They seemed like they were plugged into the system, you know, as far as, like, getting ahead and things like that. And, I haven't been to France, but I read about how things are in France, how they're basically in ghettos surrounding
right.
Paris.
Mm-hmm.
There's this hatred. I really didn't see that in New York.
So let me ask you, Tim, you were with the New York police. You've watched what's happened in London. You see that perhaps the different social structure there, the different degree of integration. Does that leave you feeling exempt from what's gone on in London today and 2 weeks ago today?
No, absolutely not. You know, all you need is a few people to pull off an operation like this. You know, I think you still have to be concerned, but I think as a general sense, the community is not a, I don't think it's a radicalized community. I really don't.
We're happy to hear that, and ever may it stay so. Tim, thanks very much for calling in from New York. Paul Rogers, in the UK, I'd like to look a little more closely at this link to Pakistan. A very vigorous and quick response there, apparently at the urging of the government in London since the July 7th attacks. At least 25 people arrested there by Pakistan's government in several major cities, raids all over the place. How strong are the links between the UK and what's going on in Pakistan, the back and forth that Peter Bergen was talking about earlier?
Well, there are all kinds of routine links. I mean, families in Britain of Pakistani origin go back and forth repeatedly. I'm going to Pakistan in a month's time. I was in the consulate in Bradford just to get my visa fairly recently, and it was crowded. There's a huge two-way traffic. The proportion of people going for other purposes is very much smaller. And in a sense, I would agree with Tim that the proportion within the Islamic communities in Britain who are radicalized to the extent of being involved in these kinds of atrocities is very small. Indeed, the anger is there, but it does not reflect by and large in the extreme actions. Nevertheless, there are elements who do take that view, and they do connect with some of the more radical Islamic elements in Pakistan. I think by and large the British authorities have only really started to waken up to this recently, and indeed the older people and the more conventional people within the Islamic communities are deeply shocked at what has happened and are hugely concerned to try and turn away some of the young, radicalized people from this degree of extremism that just a very small proportion of them have actually embraced.
Of course, it doesn't take much. Terrence Taylor, how do you interpret Pakistan's government responding so quickly with raids and lots of arrests after the July 7th attacks? Is this London putting the pressure on? Is it Pakistan having not minded the store earlier? Is this an investigation out of the UK that's pointing, putting new light on the Islamist communities in Pakistan?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise that President Musharraf would act promptly and will want to show that they have a responsible government and they're going to face down international terrorism and cooperate. There are all sorts of very strong political reasons for them doing that. But no doubt that's not to say that the British government hasn't put a lot of pressure on. But I think they probably were pushing on a door that was already open. I remember, like Paul, I do go to Pakistan from time to time, and I remember I had a meeting with President Musharraf, and this was a year after he took power, and this was to discuss nuclear issues. And I said to him, "What's your top security concern?" Thinking he was going to be talking about India. And he said, "It's radical and fundamentalism in my own country. That's my biggest threat."
But if the door is so open, why didn't these arrests take place before July 7th, before 56 deaths in London?
Well, these arrests, as far as I've heard from the arrests so far, and I just heard some information earlier, none of them have yet been linked to the bombings on July the 7th. At least that's as I've heard. So we don't know yet whether these people that have been arrested are directly linked.
Peter Bergen, let me turn to you on the same front. The UK has deep and long-standing ties in South Asia. Do you think that they may succeed where the United States, I don't know, has failed in opening Pakistan up further in getting law enforcement deeper into the fabric of that country in the wake of these attacks?
Well, you know, Terence Taylor pointed out, you know, Musharraf regards these people as an existential threat. And, I mean, two very serious assassination attempts. He's a lucky man to be alive, were directed at him by al-Qaeda and sort of affiliated groups in Pakistan. So he's personally determined. He's, you know, he's actually called for a jihad against terrorism in the last day or two. But, you know, the problem is, you know, Pakistan's a huge country, 160 million people. The Kashmiri dispute is, you know, a lot of Pakistanis, you know, are in favor of the Kashmiri militant groups. And these militant groups are really ideologically very similar to al-Qaeda. They often cooperate with al-Qaeda. And they're very popular. I mean, when the Lashkar-e-Toiba, one of the largest, has its annual gatherings, hundreds of thousands of people show up. And it has thousands of offices around the country. So there's been sort of a revolving door. You know, Musharraf will crack down on one organization, then it will simply change its name and start up again. He will arrest one of the main leaders. The guy will have a house arrest for a time, and then he'll come out. And it's just extremely problematic. And if I was a Pakistani government official answering this question, I'd say, look, you keep asking us to do more. You know, what more can we do? Hundreds of our guys have been killed in this along the border with Afghanistan. You know, our own president survived assassination attempts. You know, we also have to worry about our own political viability. If we push down too hard on the religious fundamentalists, you know, that's sort of a problem, too. So the arrests that we've seen in Pakistan have got absolutely nothing to do with the London thing. It's sort of a round up the usual suspects kind of operation, and I think the Pakistanis just did it, you know, just as a reaction.
Well, I don't know about that. The Guardian newspaper reports that the arrests were explicitly linked to the investigation.
The Guardian's wrong. I mean, I've been very carefully paying attention to the reporting, and one of the people they arrested was a guy. They're looking for the mastermind. One of the people they arrested has the same name as somebody they think might be, you know, the fifth man in all this. His name is something like Rashid. But it's a very common name, and they arrested this guy, Harun Rashid, in Pakistan, and turned out to be nothing. So they are arresting people who may be bad guys, but who don't have anything directly linked to the plot at hand.
Let's take another call. Joe's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air. What do you think, my friend?
Hi, thank you. I guess I would depend upon words of people who have been here before. Justice Brandeis said the greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning but without understanding. I think that works on both sides of the equation and both sides of the Atlantic. We have a government that's once again trying to protect us from ourselves, and I think that's a huge problem. That's that moment that we have to be most aware and most on guard to protect our liberties, because Franklin noticed 250 years ago that when you sell your liberty to protect your security, you gain neither.
But Franklin didn't have al-Qaeda. What do you mean, to protect us from ourselves?
Because the terrorists are not, the example in London is perfect. The terrorists are us. It's not people coming into our country from another country. It's not an army soldier that walks in uniform. It's the guy standing next to you at the bus stop with a backpack.
So what's your solution, Joe? Are you saying pay more attention to integrating all portions of society? Don't leave your young Muslim men alienated and outside the mainstream? That tack?
I, that's the kind of thing. But I mean, the moment we respond by making our societies more insular, not only are we losing the battle, but in a very direct sense, we've already lost it, because you can't fight terrorism that way. It's like the idea that the police keep getting bigger guns in order to fight the criminals. There's always going to be a criminal sitting out there that's going to get a bigger weapon or a better weapon, and then we're always being reactive instead of proactive.
Joe, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. Paul Rogers, how do you think that argument will go down in the UK tonight?
It won't go down very well, but in a curious way, I think it should go down well. There will be a reaction in Britain. We discussed it earlier in the program. Mm. There will be a tightening up of legislation. There is a resolute determination by Prime Minister Blair not to connect this at all with what is happening in Iraq, or indeed to some extent even in Afghanistan. But the wider issue is, and this came through, I think, very forcibly in the comments that Peter was making about Pakistan, is there is a wave of anti-Western, anti-Americanism, which is actually growing palpably in Southwest Asia and across the Middle East, and that is to do currently with the manner in which the war on terror is being fought. Now, that doesn't directly connect with the London bombings, but it provides a background, a kind of context in which I think there is a risk of increased support for groups such as Al-Qaeda. So we have to get to grips with that as well. And it is certainly the case that if you react to these sorts of attacks by clamping down hugely, you may end up actually radicalizing further elements. That has been at least the partial experience in Northern Ireland. There are no easy answers to this, but I think we have to go farther than just the traditional responses, because those do not seem to be enough at present.
Paul, let me ask you, I would have thought that with the IRA threat for all those years, that British law would already be very tough, that would already offer the government there lots of tools for dealing with terrorists.
It is pretty tough, but many of those related more specifically to the Northern Ireland issue and don't necessarily apply to the kind of circumstances we're in now. And it's also the case that many of the pretty tough rules in Northern Ireland proved to be very problematic, and essentially Northern Ireland is moving slowly but perceptibly towards peace, not just because of the counterinsurgency operations, but because of a whole range of political developments which have tended to enfranchise what was seen within itself to be a minority and disenfranchised community. Now, we're not addressing that kind of issue in global terms at present at all. The war on terror is being fought primarily as a military matter.
Peter Bergen, we just heard Paul Rogers refer to Tony Blair's very stiff and immediate rejection of any notion between these attacks and the war in Iraq. Yet we see coming out of the UK in the last couple of weeks intelligence officials having said just in the month before the July 7th attacks that, I'm quoting here, events in Iraq are continuing to act as motivation and a focus of a range of terrorist-related activity in the UK. Fair to draw a kind of motivational, provocational line to Iraq or not?
We have some very good data on this. I mean, the 2003 was the worst year for significant terrorist acts since 1982, and then those numbers then tripled in 2004. And that's right in the same time frame as the Iraq War. These things cannot be unrelated. 2004 was one of the worst years for acts, significant acts of terrorism in the modern era. They have to be related, and the anti-Americanism that was referred to earlier, I mean, our numbers sort of actually got better in Pakistan, but we're still looking at numbers where, 51% of Pakistanis, have a lot of confidence in Osama bin Laden. These numbers sort of speak for themselves, and that's also got to be something to do with the Iraq War. And I think we're just putting our heads in the sand. And that, I say that with taking no position on the Iraq War, if it's a good, bad, or indifferent thing. But let's be real about the outcomes in terms of terrorism, and let's also be very much concerned about the blowback from the war when it's finished, whether it's a year from now or 10 years from now. The foreign fighters who are training, who are fighting there, are fighting one of the world's greatest armies, as opposed to the Russian army that the Afghan Arabs were fighting, who were, demoralized conscripts. They're learning IEDs, they're learning suicide terrorism, all stuff that would have very transferable to urban terrorism in the West. We're seeing recruitment in Spain, arrests of 8 people last month. We're also seeing recruitment in France. I mean, we have a very serious problem with the Iraq War, and it's understandable that Tony Blair is choosing to sort of ignore that, but the facts, I think, sort of speak for themselves.
Terence Taylor, put yourself in the shoes of Tony Blair tonight. Both he and President Bush have said in recent days since the July 7th attacks, essentially said no retreat on Iraq. That's not the cause. That's not the issue. We have to stay the course there. Peter Bergen says, well, you may, and you can debate right or wrong, but it's going to have blowback, basically, he's saying. So what does a head of state do about that?
Well, it is a real challenge, and there is opposition to the war in not only in Britain and other European countries too, and to a certain extent in the United States, of course. But I think one mustn't lose sight of the fact, despite the major influence, and I don't want to play down that of the war in Iraq, the fact that one must look back to al-Qaeda's activities that go back to the first attempt on the World Trade Center, which was an attempt to cause very large numbers of casualties.
1993,
there's their attempt to the bombings of the airliners going out across the Pacific, which of course hundreds of casualties. And of course, you mustn't forget that 2001, 9/11 was before Iraq. And so there was an attempt to cause very large casualties in that case. But I would certainly support the point that the Iraq war has exacerbated and been some kind of recruiting sergeant.
All
but
true.
I think one needs to take a rounded view at this. And I think both President Bush and Mr. Blair, you know, will forcefully make that point. There is an issue with a very long-term campaign against terrorism. I hate the use of the word war against terrorism.
Understood.
All the civil contingency you have to take and so on.
Let me get one more call here, if I may. Megan is calling from Boston. Hi, Megan. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What I wanted to ask is, don't you think that giving all this media attention to the terrorists is actually fueling what their purpose is, which is to instill fear and to create more hatred amongst the community?
Yeah, there's even a conversation like this tonight?
Absolutely. I think that when the events happened, even before we knew whether they were Islamic terrorists or not, giving them that attention was the wrong thing to do. Rather, the solution that I propose, although I'm sure that it isn't as simple as this, would be to embrace the community and everyone kind of say, you know, we're going to take the Muslims in our society and make them one of our own, and we're going to fight this together, rather than to instill the fear.
Kind of take a Muslim to dinner under your wing. Don't rail about it on the air. Megan, our time is short, but let us pick that up. Paul Rogers, how do you think that question would be received in the UK? I mean, you're at the heart of this right now.
I think it would be received very well. People do point to the way the Spanish came together after the much worse Madrid bombings, and certainly my own part of the world. I live near two cities that are intensely multicultural. There are intensive efforts, and really very good efforts, for the communities to come together and work together.
But what about the media piece? Inevitably, the press is going to talk about these things.
Yeah,
these
yes,
are attacks,
it is, but it's also the case that the media, particularly the local media around my area, and the other, this is a region of 2 or 3 million people, has been reporting very much on the coming together of the community groups. Yes, the media inevitably focus on this, but they are also focusing in Britain on these more positive aspects. And frankly, we've had far less of a very damaging counter-reaction against Muslim communities in Britain in the last 14 or 15 days than many people feared. So that at least is one good sign in the current situation.
That's a relief. We just got 20 seconds here, Paul. Can you see this open scene being sewn back up, the UK getting a handle on this, or do you fear a drumbeat going on?
I think they may get a handle on it. It's very difficult to predict. The problem is they've got to go further than conventional counter-terrorism to address some of the real problems that are behind the ability of groups like Al-Qaeda to recruit effectively in the first place. They're not yet doing that.
Well, we hope it's not gas on a fire. It's been a very interesting conversation tonight. Paul Rogers at the University of Bradford in Bradford, England, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Terrence Taylor, Executive Director of the U.S. Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Taylor.
It's a pleasure.
Peter Bergen, always good to have you with us at the New America Foundation, author of Holy War, Inc. Peter, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.